The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
This is one of the Poetry World's great annual get-togethers, the award ceremony for the Forward Prizes for Poetry.
Why is poetry important?
Poetry is life. If it's important to you, it just is. It influences everything except making a living. You can't make a living as a poet, but that doesn't matter.
It's important because it's not the usual way of interpreting the world. You won't hear David Cameron saying things at the Tory Party conference that have anything to do with the vision of poetry.
Poetry gives people a complicity for the feelings that they have, but don't necessarily have the language to express themselves. And a lot of people turn to poetry in times of great need, grief, broken heart, that kind of thing. And there they find a sense of understanding, and it makes them feel less alone.
What I love about poetry is it manages to distill things into so few words. So many forms of literature are so verbose.
What separates us from the animals is language. And poetry uses language at its most intense and suggestive.
You will see that every single crucial thing that's happened in our lives in the last decade has been dealt with by poetry first.
The Forwards, which are three prizes for Best Collection, Best First Collection and Best Individual Poem, are the richest poetry prizes in the UK and a great arbiter of talent. The Best Collection gong has been won in the past by Tom Gunn, Ted Hughes and Caroline Duffy, among others. And tonight is the prize's 20th anniversary. So without further ado, let's find out who is this year's winner.
This year's shortlisted poets were John Burnside for Black Cat Bone, David Harsent for Night, Geoffrey Hill for Clavix, Michael Longley for 100 Doors, Dean Erxer for Voices Over Water, and Sean O'Brien for November. And the winner of the Forward Prize for Best Collection 2011 is John Burnside.
This is a book that came into being because of hyenas and pink-footed geese. Okay, this poem is called On the Fairy Tale Ending. Begin with the fen for yourself of all the loves you learned about in storybooks. Fish scale and fox print graven on the hand forever, and a tiny hook and eye and fastened in the sweet meat of a heart you thought would never grieve or come undone. May, and already it's autumn, broken gold and crimson in the medieval beech woods where our shadows come and go, no darker than the figures in a book of changes till they're hexed and singled out for something chill and slender in this world, more sleight of hand than sorrow or safekeeping. Thank you very much, thank you. I've been shortlisted a few times before. I'm quite practiced at standing in the crowd and enjoying a colleague's success, as it were. So it's great, it's wonderful. And it's nice it's the 20th anniversary because, you know, the Forward's done a lot for poetry, actually, and the anthologies are always, you know, an event in the year.
You mentioned pink-footed geese. I was rather intrigued by that.
I live in what's called the Carnby Arncroagh Triangle. It's one of the most important areas for pink-footed geese who fly in from Iceland over the winter. They overwinter near me. I mentioned them for a reason. I also mentioned hyenas. I just love hyenas. But the reason I mentioned pink-footed geese is because there's a lot of talk in Scotland about big wind turbines. You know, they want to put big turbines up where geese come in, and they're actually coming in off their migratory routes and beginning to settle in bodies of water and fields in the area, for example, where I live. And new work that's been done in the States suggests that the numbers of bird deaths have been seriously underestimated, and I'm very concerned. I just love birds, basically.
Now, you, among the influences you cite are art. We're in Somerset House, and
yes,
it's got the Wallace Collection, of course. And,
yes,
and one of your influences is Bruegel.
Yes. But Bruegel, actually, in many ways, this book began, the other side of this book, if you like. I was actually in Brussels, and I was doing something, an event there, and
I can't remember exactly what happened. I arrived early and I thought, well, what do you do in Brussels when you arrive? You go to Musée du Beaux-Arts. And I went over there and I went around the Bruegel room about 100 times, as I always do. And then, you know, you think, well, Bruegel's off limits after Auden. You can't write a poem about the Bruegels in the Musée du Beaux-Arts. He's done it. He did it more than once. And then I thought, well, okay, you know, why not? And I was just responding to those poems, but to those paintings. And I've always loved Bruegel so much. I mean, the thing that Bruegel has lots of, and that I may have lacked myself, or I felt that I had lacked in my own work until recently, was this kind of human quality. I was more concerned with landscape and maybe solitary figures in the landscape, kind of really post-romantic stuff. And that I wanted to write a book about romantic love and pain and disappointment and hope that comes through that. And the ability to be persuaded, which is how the book ends, the idea of, you know, I'm pretty hard-bitten, but I'm prepared to be persuaded one more time. And Bruegel seems to be about that. Bruegel seems to know all of the human failings and the sin, but he still loves people and he still loves the way they're persuaded by, you know, energy and love and passion and sensuality and imagination.
Forwards are a prize for British poets, but English language poetry is currently making inroads into Europe too. Paris has just enjoyed its first ever performance poetry show in English. I hand over the channel now to Fikre Gibbons.
I'm backstage at the Trianon Theatre in Montmartre in Paris. It's one of the real mythical venues of Paris, a place where Piaf, Jacques Dutronc, even Johnny Halliday has played. But even in that time, in 150 years that this place has existed, it's never seen a night like tonight, because tonight, for the first time in its very long history, Trianon is going to host a performance poetry night. Performance poetry and music, actually. And it's two British performers. There's a British singer-songwriter, Piers Fucini, who's quite a big thing here. He was shortlisted a few years ago for the French equivalent of the Mercury Prize. And the performance poet, the queen of performance poetry, in fact, Francesca Beard. France has remarkably remained immune to the kind of international sort of fashion for slam poetry that's kind of swept the rest of Europe and America. And we'll see how it goes down.
There were voices shot to the skies. There were cries sent to unblind eyes. There were downtown palms on rays. From fist across the drowned out in praise. There were shouts shot from the back of tongues. Swallowed down throats to choked up lungs. Joy brimming from the deepest well. From the source sprung to break the spell. How low am I to fall? How low, how low? How low am I?
So, my name is Francesca. Actually, I have two names. I have an English name and a Chinese name, and my English name is Francesca, except it's an Italian name, and it means Lady from France, which doesn't at all describe me, but that's my name. And my Chinese name is Mei Yi, which means beautiful and useful. Yeah, doesn't describe me either at all, so there you are. And my brother's name is Matthew, which is an ancient Hebrew name meaning gift from God. But we call him Mop, which is an old English word meaning long-handled tool for cleaning spillages from the floor. And the reason I'm talking about my brother is that it was him, Mop, who inspired me to become a performance poet. And this is why. Because when he was 2 years old, he was still wearing a nappy. Do you say nappy? Yeah, you know, like diaper, nappy. And his head was quite big, slightly unstable. And the best thing about him at that time, when he was two, he had this voice, which was very deep, with a lisp, and an unaccountable Yorkshire accent, which was really strange, because we lived in Malaysia, and we weren't... So... So anyway, I'm now going to perform for you the piece that he invented when he was two and which inspired me to become a poet. So here we go. Once there was an egg and it growed up to the sky. Black was its face all black. And it fell down to the ground with a plump. And that is the end of my egg song.
You gotta be a wee bit cheeky to put on a poetry reading in Paris. A poetry reading in English and call it Standing Room. But Gemma Burrell from Shakespeare and Company, you must be thrilled all these people have come, because I mean, it's jammed in there tonight.
The thing was, it was La Rentrée right now. It's the beginning of that. But in August, when we put the tickets on sale, everyone was on holiday, so there was no Parisians. So we were quite surprised by all of the tickets selling, basically. They have slam and they have poetry, but they don't have the stuff in between. They don't have the lyricism of poetry, but performed in a really kind of energetic way. It is something really new in France, something really new that we're hopefully going to develop here a bit more.
It's mostly French people here, isn't it?
There's a lot of French, but there's a lot of expats and Anglophones as well, and a lot of French people that speak English and that have a real passion for the English language, really. Yeah.
One, two, three, four. Fluffy trot down the road. Fluffy tail, fluffy nose. Fluffy warm, fluffy sun. Fluffy wag, fluffy tongue. Fluffy brick, fluffy ear. Fluffy car, fluffy hair. Fluffy sea, fluffy tree. Fluffy stop, fluffy wee. That you never get this bit in actual superhero stories, do you? But I can tell you that Batman and Spider-Man and all of those, they need to urinate like everyone. So it's poetry, it's a bit more realistic. Okay. One, two, three, four. Fluffy trot down the road, fluffy tail, fluffy nose, fluffy sniff, fluffy bin, mean man shouting, get away you mongrel, mean man smell bad, fluffy under fluffy fence, fluffy spy, crime offence, bad man terrorist, picture on the wanted list, fluffy fly through the air, fluffy wind, fluffy fur, man fluffy roll around, man fluffy on the ground. Biff, oof, scratch, claw, wham, bam, punch, jaw, gun, arm, bite, drop, wham, bam, pow, bop, man run, fluff, leap, man pound, man sleep, fluff, sniff, phone, find, poor, 999. That's an emergency number in Britain, okay. Fluff, sit, lick, paw, wait for police car. Fluff, woof, statement, bad man, prison sent. Fluff, good, fluff, go, fluff, trot, down road. There you go, true story.
I started out doing open mics, and at that time there was a growing kind of slam scene. It's quite a competitive, gladiatorial type of scenario where you have a live audience and you have a number of poets. Each poet gets 3 minutes, and then the poems are judged by the audience. So basically you get scored from 1 to 10 on how loudly the audience claps. What I much prefer doing is longer, more extended stuff where I get to develop a dialogue with the audience.
Never lose and never learn.
The first time I saw her, I think it was amazing. I mean, she's great, she's funny. It's really like, you know, she gets good with the public, there was a good reaction, you know, we get involved in it. I think it's really great. I mean, I'm not like a poetry fan, I'm not really into it, but it was really, really amazing. I really love it.
Do you think, I mean, there's a lot of English humor in this, which is very, very, very much based on self-deprecation, autodérision. And is this something that people will connect with here?
I think yes, but not as much. I think it's an English thing too, with the British English and
So yeah, it's kind of good for us to get familiar with it, because even stand up in France is not like that big. So poetry, like no way.
Art forms may be feeling the squeeze, but us poets, we smirk in the face of economic downturn. You know, royalties are literally nothing to me. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking she's so smug, but it's only an adjustment. No. Poets are cockroaches. Even in the event of a global fiscal apocalypse, there will still abide some croaky-voiced weirdo muttering about the dim receding tides. Even when all other art forms have fallen into the sea, a loon will be scratching words in the wet shoreline with a stick. So that's good.
Speak out, tongue. Find the word. Speak out, tongue.
That was Francesca Beard expressing her belief that poetry will always be with us. Yesterday was National Poetry Day, and as part of the celebrations, we saw the publication of a magnificent new anthology carrying the daunting title The 20th Century in Poetry. I'm joined in the studio now by one of its co-editors, Michael Hulse. So, Michael, where did this project spring from?
The roots of it are fairly complicated, I have to say. I'll try and simplify. The thing is that I had, on the one hand, for a long time, about 20 years at least, wanted to do a book of contemporary writing from across the whole English-speaking world, contemporary poetry. And I pitched the ideas to publishers, and they'd all said, this is how poetry should be approached now. All the poets are on the circuit together, they read each other, they're bouncing off each other. The whole national boxes idea is out of date. We would love to do this book, it should exist, but the huge permissions fees make it impossible. So I always got turned away. And for me, it was a book that I'd love to have done, but couldn't. Simon Ray, my co-editor, at the end of the 90s, I think it was 99 or maybe 2000 that the book appeared, did a book of 100 poems, one for each year of the 20th century, with Faber, called News That Stays News, Pound's definition of poetry. And this book didn't get as much attention as it probably should have done, but it was noticed by Felix Dennis, who has a great love of poetry and a great deep wallet. And Felix said to Simon, a bigger book on the same principles should exist. You should do more poems per year and cover the whole century for the whole English-speaking world. And Simon's book was essentially a British and Irish with a bit of American. Simon worked at it for a while and then figured that what he would really like was somebody who knew a little more about some patches around the world, such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, India, Anglophone Africa, that he didn't feel entirely secure with. So he asked me if I'd like to join him in the project, and I thought, of course, would I? Hey. I guess for both of us, it was on the one hand drawing on a lifetime's reading, but on the other hand, once you're actually doing the nitty-gritty work, you're constantly coming up against poets where you think, ah, I don't really think I've read this person properly. Mm. Get the stuff out of the library, sit down, start on page one, go through to page 923, and just read the whole lot. I remember, for example, Carl Sandburg, who was a poet that I have to confess I would probably have been a little sniffy and superior about. I went back and read him from start to finish, and I thought, this is a seriously underrated poet. For myself, I can say that the first time I was really on the poetry circuit internationally was 85, when I was invited over to Canada, to Toronto. And while I was there, I asked the editor of one of the principal poetry magazines to take me to a bookstore and just show me the half dozen Canadian poetry books of the last 10 years that he thought I had to read. And so I bought those books and took them home. And I have to say he had wonderful taste, because those were writers, Rue Borson, Don Coles among them, who have stood the test of time. They're fantastic writers. Wherever I've been over the last 25 years, I've asked people the same question. Just tell me which of the writers that I should be reading.
What interested me most from in terms of the selections that you've made was probably the first and the last poem. The first poem is Hardy's The Darkling Thrush, and the last poem is by a man called Geoffrey Harrison. It's called Pale Blue City. There must be such weight on those two choices. How you'd finally come to the decision to have those two bookending your anthology?
I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was spectre grey, and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine-stem scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. The land's sharp features seemed to be the century's corpse outlent, his crypt the cloudy canopy, the wind his death lament. The ancient pulse of germ and birth was shrunken, hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once, a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the glowing gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through his happy good-night air some blessed hope, whereof he knew, and I was unaware.
It's a very, very curious poem, isn't it? Because it's a poem that is heartbreakingly mixed between the darkness and the light, the despairing instinct and the hope instinct, and they're almost at war with each other. And Hardy was out of sympathy with some of the embroilments of Britain at the time, such as the Boer War. And at the same time, he's talking about the sheer joy that we believe to be in the song of the bird. I mean, let's leave the ornithologists out, who'll tell us that it's about territorial claims and so on, why birds sing. But actually, he's seeing it as joy and just whistling the pure spirit of life into the breeze and so on. And that extraordinary balance there between the doomfulness and the hope and joy is a heartbreaking thing in that poem. And it's perfectly positioned on the cusp of the old century and the new century. The Geoffrey Harrison poem, Pale Blue City, is dated to exactly a century later, the 31st of December 2000. This poem describes New York City seen from the plane, and he's thinking, how beautiful. And it all looks so wonderful to him. And he looks down, among other things, he sees the tiny Twin Towers. And the very last words of the poem give this vision of the city almost as a gift to his partner. He says, here, take it before it disappears. So touching, because we know what history has in store for New York and particularly for the Twin Towers very soon. I think of that poem now in a very strange way as being the great 9/11 poem written before it ever happened.
I've never seen it like this. From up here, the sun sinking fiery on the horizon. But down there, it has already set. And the city, laid out on its recognizable island, is a beautiful pale ash blue because of the snow and the evening. The streetlights are already lit, but it isn't dark yet. Everything is still visible in the city where we once lived, but long ago. And now it's all small. The tiny paired towers of the Trade Center, Midtown stacked up like a digital mountain, the George Washington Bridge with its festoon of white Christmas lights, Central Park and Azure Band. It's too far away to see the copper roofs of Morningside Heights, their green subsumed in the blue of memory, or covered by the snow that shut the city down our first year together. People skiing down Broadway, everything muffled as we looked down from our window, already seeing it all from above, but not from as far away as this, the lights glittering as if through a liquid. I want it all to stay just like this. I wish I could give you this pale blue city under the glass of a plane window, like a snow globe. All of New York and our time there held in your hand. But the plane is moving on. The city slips away. And now it's getting dark. The landscape turns as black as space, and the orange lights of other cities slide underneath in spidery galaxies, as if light years separated us from that era. And yet I try to hold it inside me as the plane begins its descent toward our present life together. Here, take it before it disappears.
It seemed to us that some poems, although written much longer after the event, seemed to cry out to be positioned in the midst of the events that they were touching upon. I'll take as an example one by the Canadian poet E.J. Pratt, not the most fortunate name for a poet, perhaps, but in the 30s, he produced a long epic on the subject of the loss of the Titanic. Now, we could have run that extract that we've printed here in the 1930s, but actually it doesn't feel right at all, because everybody thinks Titanic, they think 1912, most people actually are pretty aware of the date, but they also think other thoughts, such as the symbolic end of that high bourgeois era of luxury, which had a particular kind of Victorian, Edwardian style to it, and which was just doomed, and it perfectly symbolizes the end of that era, which definitively ended in 1914. And we thought, that's the place for it. It just doesn't make sense putting it in the 30s. And so as we went through, we simply kept on taking that approach. I can see that there might be disagreement over that. So people can just argue it out if they want.
Just half of the fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Having all of the poems in front of you now, what did you think were the dominant themes to emerge from 20th century poetry?
What I am comfortable with is saying that the 20th century, in some respects, was grim. That was the word that your literary editor used the other day on Radio 2. Mm. And I think she's absolutely right. But it is also absolutely uplifting. And we have uplifting poems and just ordinary human experience poems in there as well. So in a way, I'm not meaning to cop out, but I really am going to resist this temptation to nail the thing into the coffin of one or two themes. It's I hope, a sprawling, baggy book with a lot of things to offer. Mm.
If you were giving me this book as a present and you wanted to hook me in, which page would you open it on?
One is Anthony Hecht's poem, "It Out Herod's Herod, Pray You Avoid It." It's a heartbreaking poem which turns out just in the last word to be a poem about the Holocaust. The poem is about putting his children to bed. They've been watching TV, they've been watching the giant, the witch, all the children's kinds of baddies on children's television. He puts them to bed, he knows that later he's going to mix himself his drink and sit there watching adult kind of evil after the watershed. And his thoughts are about evil and the kinds of things that parents can protect their children from. And the poem is written in a little sing-song, trimeter, nursery rhyme kind of way that sounds very faux naive. And the last lines go, "And that their sleep be sound, I say this child amass, who could not, at one time, have saved them from the gas." Anthony Hecht was a GI in the American forces when the Flossenbürg concentration camp was liberated. He had seen a death camp. He was a Jewish poet himself. To my mind, that is one of the most profoundly affecting Holocaust poems. I can't think of a better one in the English language. And it delivers its punch just in that last word, because suddenly the whole poem shifts. And you think, this isn't just about daddy and the children and the television and the it's about the big evil. And what can we do? It's just heartbreaking.
But poetry, of course, has never been confined to the page. As well as the poetry slams and performances we heard about earlier, poetry can make its way into the physical world too. The poet and playwright Lavinia Greenlaw is currently working on a series of audio-visual poetry installations, and her latest, to be found at St Pancras Station, is called Audio Obscura. Lindsay Irvin met her on the concourse to find out more.
You come into the station and there's a peculiar booth from where you collect a set of headphones, and these are special noise-cancelling headphones which completely encase you. And then basically you're sent off to wander around the station to listen and to see what you see.
And what you hear as you're wandering the busy hum of St Pancras is a string of disconnected monologues.
Yes, it's really an adventure that begins in the overheard and ends in the interior lives of the people around you. As I was working on it, my first thought was wanting people to experience a heightened sense of listening in on strangers going by. But this developed into interior thoughts and really into the things people don't know they want to say. So each voice is saying something that in some way is a bit uncomfortable, which might make you want to not listen, to go away or to come closer, or indeed in some cases to rescue them.
Right, because some of the things we hear are very banal and some of them appear to be opening up on some quite horrific material.
Yes, I mean, here we are now and there are people around us, and most people look quite serene. They're waiting for a train. Some of them will be thinking about what they're going to buy from the supermarket on the way home. Some of them could be thinking about somebody who left them that morning, or their dead child, or the fact they've just been told they're very ill. I mean, I wanted to explore the way in which we level ourselves out externally, and particularly when we're on journeys, we kind of absent ourselves and we feel freed up in the sense that we are a stranger among strangers and that we're neither where we've come from nor where we're going. People do often use those times without meaning to think about the things they don't really want to think about. And of course, we can't tell that. So I'm trying to take us in.
As we're hearing these very private thoughts, we're also seeing the faces of strangers, and the implication is that we link those interior thoughts to the strangers' faces we're seeing.
Yes, I had thought originally that because this is basically the idea is a sound version of the camera obscura, that we would build a dark room and people would go in there and listen and look out upon a crowd. But when we were testing the voices, we realized that you can't help but impose what you're listening on what you see. And because these monologues are built out of 12 situations, which I really try to boil down to essential station states of mind, if you like, it seems that you always spot at least one person who exactly fits that voice at the time you're hearing it. And the exciting thing is, for me, I have no control over that aspect of it at all.
You're very carefully withholding quite a lot of information. These are not stories that are ever finished.
No, they are complete in that I wrote 12 complete monologues, and the actors certainly had a sense of what they were doing and why. But what I tried to do was to break those down into the kind of fragments that we overhear, which aren't necessarily the ones that, say, on the page or in the theatre would deliver the information. I realised that something very strange and different happens when it's the overheard, and sometimes it's just the very small words that give you the DNA of a narrative.
Listen. The heart of it.
Socks, water rate, nail scissors, birthday card. DNA. Under the fingernails, traces of lead. Someone must have seen. Bulbs, the garden. Oh, God, the garden. To get round to the garden. Pattern of cuts, precise, considered, round her waist. What does that mean? Round her waist, like a belt. Any more delicate. A chain, almost a daisy chain. Such a tiny waist. Affidavit, lunch, money, wool.
There is always something left behind. Something slips, or is lost, or forgotten. And it's all right.
There's no door, nothing. I'm made of walls.
I want you to know that someone has seen.
I worked very closely with the sound designer, Tim Barker, who embedded these voices in station atmosphere to act almost like static in the listener's ear. And then the listener starts spinning out of that what the possible story might be. I think another different way in which people react to the piece is that they will find within it something they recognise of themselves, which of course is why we respond to anything.
Did you spend a lot of time hanging around on station concourses in order to research this?
I did. I spent a lot of time. I wanted to think about how long people are there and what for and what they do, and why they might be there. And so I let myself speculate and listen in. And I came up with these 12 characters in these 12 conditions. They're very basic conditions, like feeling stuck, being in a desperate hurry, trying to escape something, feeling free. The sort of person for whom being at the station is an everyday experience, so they're quite calm and it's all routine. And then built narratives and characters out of those. But I think that if it works, it's because I started by trying to see what really happened at the station, didn't just invent it. And I hope that when people get these headphones, it does make them feel both protected and permitted to look and connect with what's going on around them in ways they wouldn't usually, but also that they are at the same time more deeply connected with what's going on, because what I'm trying to do is dissolve boundaries that we forget are there.
Lavinia Greenlaw, and you can experience her audio obscura at St Pancras every day until the 23rd of October, from noon until 8 p.m. It shouldn't be missed, and, crucially, it's free. So I hope you made the most of National Poetry Day. There's plenty to enjoy on our site and in the paper, and Richard Lee is here with me now to tell us what's coming up over the next few days.
In review this weekend, we celebrate 20 years of the Forward Prize, and Geoffrey Eugenides talks to Adam Thirlwell about his latest novel. On the website, our World Literature Tour heads off to Colombia this month, though we haven't had the expected flood of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, so any Marquez fans out there, come and join the party. We're also putting out a call for readers to recommend their favourite independent bookshops on our bookshop map. The Guardian Observer Book Swap is still going strong, so keep leaving your books for others to find, and keep telling us about the books that you've picked up. We also have 3 more days of audiobook CDs to give away with the paper. Rudyard Kipling's Just So Stories today, The Cat Mummy by Jacqueline Wilson on Saturday, and Just William by Richmal Compton to finish things off on Sunday.
Thanks, Richard, and my thanks to all who took part today, and to our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Sarah Crown. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.